Good afternoon. If you can find a seat, sit down and we'll get started. We may have standing room only today. Look at this wonderful crowd. There are a few seats here and there, so come look for them. Welcome to Random Reviews. Thank you all for coming. My name is Deborah Goldenberg. I'm from the Friends of the Library, and I coordinate the Random Review program. Very happy to have John Frohnmayer here today to do the review, and in a minute I will get Sarah Swanberg up here to introduce him. I'd like to give a big thank you to the Friends of the Library for supporting this program, and also to Alpha Graphics, which is a printing and graphics business on 9th Street near Garfield, and they print our posters for us free of charge. And they also give us a hefty discount on other things. And they're very strong library supporters. So support Alpha Graphics. They're good folks. Friends of the Library is having a holiday book sale on Saturday, December 6th from 10 to 4 right in this room. There are wonderful books for sale. We save the very best of the donations all year for this sale. So come to the book sale on December 6th if you can. Next month's random review will be Molly Gloss's book, The Hearts of Horses. And that will be on Wednesday, December 10th at the same time, same place. And our reviewer is Erin Call from right here at the library. And she is a well-established horse person, and she is going to give the review. I think it will be wonderful. So now, I would like to ask Sarah Swanberg, the Executive Director of the Corvallis Arts Center, to come up and introduce our speaker. And you can...
Thank you. Yes, I'm so short that I always find I'm moving these things around. I have the great pleasure of introducing John Frohnmayer today and telling you a little bit about him. I think I may be repeating what you already know, but he is an author himself. He wrote Out of Tune, Listening to the First Amendment, Leaving Town Alive, Confessions of an Art Warrior. He's been a trial lawyer, former chairman of the NEA. He is currently an on-campus affiliated faculty member at OSU. He doesn't do anything in his life, as you see. He considered a run for the Senate seat, which I was supporting full-heartedly. I hear him on the City Club of Eugene. I see his name on the board of directors at the Oregon Council for the Humanities. I run into him on the advisory board for the OSU Art Department. He's quite an amazing man. We're very lucky to have him in town. And the most recent thing I enjoyed was Spin, his musical, which he wrote and was performed at OSU, and for that he won a Literary Arts Fellowship. So it's a pleasure to introduce John Frohnmayer.
There are a couple of seats. There's one in the front row, both here and here. Anyone would like to take those, please don't hesitate either now or during the course of this random review. In 1947, Aaron Copland was commissioned to write a piece on a prominent American, and he chose Abraham Lincoln as his subject. It's called Lincoln Portraits. I had the honor of performing this with the Southern Oregon Symphony last year, and then this year with the Mozart Players, reading the narration. And I'd like to start to get you in the mood, both musically and intellectually, of Abraham Lincoln, playing the third movement of that, which lasts about 7 minutes, of the American Abraham Lincoln Portrait.
That is what he said. escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. Struggle between two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world. It is the same spirit that says, you toil and work and earn bread, and I'll eat it, no matter in what shape it comes, whether from the mouth of a king who seeks to bestride the people of his own nation and live by the fruit of their labor, or from one race of men as an apology for enslaving another race. It is the same tyrannical principle. He said, as I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. This expresses my idea of democracy. Whatever differs from this, to the extent of the difference, thank you. For on the battleground of Gettysburg, this is what he said. He said that from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. Resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom. And that government of the people, by the people, and for the people, shall not perish.
Pretty strong stuff. I tell you that narrating that, I had to really get my game face on to keep from blubbering at the end. It gives you some sense of the power of the spoken word that Lincoln so ably commanded. And in my view, reading Doris Kearns Goodwin's book and other things about Lincoln over the course of my life, I think he was a great politician for at least two reasons. The first is that he could read people in an extraordinary way. He had a real sense of when the populace would be ready and receptive for any particular thing that he wanted to promote or, in fact, to keep from happening. And that was true in terms of the preservation of the Union, which was his primary goal as the Civil War started. And it was true with the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. And the second thing, beyond reading people and from that getting this consummate sense of timing, he communicated through stories, through parables, if you will, with a great deal of humor. And while, as you hear in the narration and you see throughout this book, he was a quiet man and a melancholy man, he was also a very funny man. And that was, again, his sense of personal timing in terms of telling stories. And the way that really came about is that Abraham Lincoln's mother died. His mother's name was Nancy Hanks, by the way, which is interesting to me because the first chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts was named Nancy Hanks. His mother died when he was nine, but his father was uneducated, but a great storyteller, and they lived on the Cumberland Trail. The Cumberland Trail went from Lexington to Knoxville. No, Lexington to Nashville. Sorry, Louisville to Nashville. And the itinerant travelers would come by, and the young Abraham Lincoln would sit in the corner as they told tales by the firelight. And then he would stay up half the night rehearsing these stories himself so that the next day he could stand on a tree stump or a log and tell them to his friends. And from that, he cultivated a sense of storytelling that allowed his stories to have shelves in our minds so that they could be remembered and repeated. And that is, in my view, the consummate characteristic of a successful politician, somebody who can engage us by telling us our own stories so that we understand both ourselves and are able to tell others about them. The other thing that he did that started his political career, really, was that he decided to practice law, and he didn't sit at the feet of anybody. Typically in those days, you would read law by apprenticing yourself to a lawyer and getting that kind of introduction. But Abraham Lincoln apprenticed himself, in his own words, to no one. Instead, he got Blackstone's commentaries. He got various other legal books of those days. And as he was wont to do, studied them, memorized great passages as he had in self-educating himself, memorizing large sections of Shakespeare and Pilgrim's Progress and Aesop's Fables and Shakespeare. So this was a man with tremendous curiosity, with tremendous intellectual power, but more than any of that, with tremendous drive and desire. And he recognized that he was exceptional at a very early age. He ran for political office first when he was 23. Of course, he got waxed. But the interesting thing about that is that out of the 300 votes in his hometown, he got 277. He just was unknown elsewhere around Illinois when he was running for the Illinois State Legislature. How he fixed that was that in those days, as a lawyer, and he began practicing when he was 25, there were circuit riders, and that is a judge and probably half a dozen to eight lawyers who would go around from community to community and try cases, everything from contests about property to contests of wills to any kind of criminal law. And there is a great example that Abraham Lincoln gave of how you ask one too many questions on cross-examination. This is not in the book, but it's in the lore. And that was a case of mayhem where someone had bitten off another person's ear. And the cross-examination question was, so you didn't see him bite the ear, did you? No, sir. So you don't know whether he did or not. Saw him spit it out. Well, this book, entitled Team of Rivals, is really about Lincoln and the people whom he ran against for the nomination, the Republican nomination, for president in 1860. Now, the Republican Party at that time was only 6 years old and had really been formed by a coalition of anti-slavery Democrats, ex-Whigs, a smattering of know-nothings and various other politicos, and holding that party together was a real feat of political showmanship on Lincoln's part. So let's start with the cast of characters. First we have William Seward. And Seward was the senator from New York. He had also been governor. And he was the front runner for the 1860 nomination. In fact, he was so much the front runner that he was ensconced in his home in New York, and his loyal followers were out in the yard by the thousands waiting for the news that he had been nominated. The nominating convention was in Chicago, Illinois, at what was called the Corn Palace. Of course, that word never came because Lincoln got the nomination. But William Seward was the front runner, and he was the protege of Thurlow Weed. Who was essentially the kingmaker, the boss in New York. Next we have Salmon Chase. That's right, salmon, just like the fish. And Salmon Chase wanted desperately his entire life to be president. He did not get the nomination when Lincoln got it, and he continued to try to get the nomination at least four more times over the course of his lifetime. He had a daughter named Kate, who features prominently in this book. Kate was 19 when Lincoln was inaugurated and was, by all reports, extraordinarily beautiful and extraordinarily talented and, unlike many women of the time, very versed and knowledgeable and interested in politics. So we'll put down Kate here. And she was something of a rival to Mary Lincoln. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. And then, incidentally, Salmon Chase was from Ohio. And then the third rival was Edward Bates. was from Missouri and was described as something of a senior statesman. He had held a lot of different positions and was well regarded in politics generally. Lincoln's game plan was to try to be second on everybody's list, so that if Seward didn't get it, the Seward supporters would go to Lincoln. If Chase didn't get it, they would go to Lincoln. If Bates didn't get it, they would go to Lincoln. And that's essentially what happened. There was Bates was able to keep Seward from getting the nomination on the first vote, and Chase really didn't figure in very strongly over the course of the thing. And by the second vote, Lincoln was almost tied with Seward, and by the third vote, he was the nominee, which absolutely flabbergasted the Eastern establishment. Here was this unknown, quote, rail splitter from out in Illinois somewhere that nobody had ever heard of. And the Southern press was just having a field day with this, because they called him an ape and an uneducated goon. And there was some reason for this perception, because as Doris Kearns Goodwin points out, Abraham Lincoln was an odd character physically. He walked flat-footed, and so he would sort of stomp along as opposed to walk along. When he was on a horse, typically his pants would hike up around his knees and his bare legs would be hanging down almost to the ground. And there were a lot of things about him that were pretty easy to caricature. But he got in his mind, almost as soon as he was elected, the clear perception that he needed all three of these men in order to have an administration that could deal with the impending crisis, and that was the impending dissolution of the Union. And so he set out to make that happen. And he first offered Seward Secretary of State. And Doris Kearns Goodwin goes over the back and forth about that, but I think what was most interesting about it is that Thurlow Weed invited Lincoln to come to New York to talk about the nomination. Lincoln wisely says no. And then Thurlow Weed suggests that they meet on neutral ground, and Lincoln says no. And finally, Thurlow Weed goes to Springfield, Illinois, to talk to Lincoln, and the deal is cut. So Lincoln established right away who was boss, but he did, by this, also get Seward to be Secretary of State. Then he offered Bates Attorney General, G, and Chase Secretary of the Treasury, which was perhaps the most important position, because by that then, Chase was able to figure out with his banking skills how to finance this government that was going into the most expensive war that we have ever had, both in terms of its cost in money and its cost in lives. Two other names that ought to be up here just to get the cast of characters. One is Stephen Douglas. He of the Lincoln-Douglas debates in 1858, of which there were seven. And these debates were perhaps the most famous of American debates. There were seven of them. They had the same format each time, which was the first speaker spoke for an hour, the next speaker spoke for an hour and a half, and then the first speaker spoke for an hour. A half an hour. So a three-hour span in which, according to all reports, the audiences were held spellbound. Given our 15-second attention spans today, that's hard to conceive. But the other thing that happened in the Lincoln-Douglas debates is that there were stenographers there who took down every word, and those debates were printed in their entirety in the newspapers of that day. The United States, at the time of the Civil War, had a population of about 23 million people, and we had far more newspapers and periodicals then than we have now. The populace was widely read, tremendously politically aware. and there were lots and lots of sources to get the news. The other is Frederick Douglass. Two S's on the end. Who was the spokesperson for the Negro race? He had been he was a slave, obviously. He had been educated by the wife of the family that owned him until her husband found out that she was educating this slave and forbade it. And he said, as is quoted in the book, that it was a disservice for him to learn to read and write because he then realized the poor condition in which he was without remedy to change it. Frederick Douglass, through most of Lincoln's career, was an opponent of Lincoln in the sense that he thought Lincoln was not committed sufficiently to the liberation of the slaves. And it was not until Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation that Douglass really became a total ally of Lincoln and was quoted to say that he visited Lincoln at the White House, and at no time did he get the sense that he was being treated other than as an equal. Which is an amazing statement for Abraham Lincoln, because Abraham Lincoln didn't start the Civil War with the notion that slaves were equal, nor did he really feel that they should be emancipated. In the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Lincoln's position was always that slavery should be allowed to continue to exist where it existed. The debate was really about the territories, about New Mexico and California and all of the other territories that were out there. And Douglass took the position that there should be local sovereignty. In other words, the new states should be able to decide for themselves whether to be free or slave. Lincoln took the position that if the Declaration of Independence has any meaning whatsoever, there cannot be slavery. And his feeling was that if you prohibit slavery everywhere it isn't currently, that ultimately it would die out. Well, we talked just a little bit, sort of going back about Lincoln's education, but what Lincoln said about himself was that in all total, over the course of his lifetime, his schooling in a schoolroom amounted to less than a year. And that was partly because his father hired him out as a hired hand very early in his career, or in his life, butchering hogs, digging wells, clearing land. And Lincoln could outjump and outrun and outwrestle all of the other boys that he was with. And in fact, he continued throughout his life to be extraordinarily physically strong. She gives an example in the book. They were on a steamer during the Civil War. Lincoln was going down into Chesapeake Bay to visit the troops. And as they were kind of just messing around on deck, Lincoln held out an axe with his at arm's length with his thumb and forefinger and held it for far longer than any of the young sailors on the ship could do it. So here is a guy who essentially recognizes his attributes and his ambitions and nominates himself. Self-nomination, one of the great things about a country like the United States. You can do that. Lincoln realized that slavery was morally wrong. But he also recognized that it was constitutionally permissible. I don't know how many of you read the Constitution on a regular basis. I hadn't have mine here. It's Article 4, Section 6. No person held to service or labor in one state, under the laws thereof, escaping unto another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due. It's right there in your Constitution. Of course, it is abrogated by the 13th Amendment. But nonetheless, there it is. The Constitution, incidentally, deals with slavery in about four different places, and never is the word slavery used. It's service or labor, because they recognized that they were dealing with an extraordinarily difficult subject here. But Lincoln's dilemma was this. He is, by oath, as a lawyer, bound to serve the Constitution, and yet he knows that what the Constitution requires is morally wrong. In 1793, Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Law, which was the implementation of the constitutional provision that I just read to you. And throughout the turbulent 1850s, the debate was whether or not to further strengthen the Fugitive Slave Law, along with this question of whether or not the admittees to the Union ought to be slave or free or have the choice. And what happened with the Compromise of 1850, which Stephen Douglas was a proponent of and helped move through the Senate, is that not only was the Fugitive Slave Law strengthened, but the local choice option for new territories, new states coming in from the territories, was adopted so that this was one of the ways that the Republican Party came into being, a sense that there had to be a new political force to deal with the issue of slavery. And incidentally, William Seward, Salmon Chase, and Edward Bates were all actively and articulately anti-slave, much more so, really, than Lincoln, who was the moderate of these four people. So Lincoln is elected in the elections of 1860, but he doesn't take office at that time until March 4th of 1861. Other things that had happened in that recent past were that Uncle Tom's Cabin was published by Harriet Beecher Stowe in 1852. And in its first year, Uncle Tom's Cabin sold over 300,000 copies, which was more than any book, save only the Bible. Then, when the Lincoln-Douglas debates took place, Lincoln, for the first time, got a national prominence, which was really the impetus for his presidency, his run for the presidency, because he was then he became widely known outside of just his home state of Illinois. Then in 1857 came the Dred Scott decision. Dred Scott, as you know, was a slave. He had escaped to, I think, Missouri, where under the laws of Missouri he was a free man. His owner tried to get him back. The decision went through the lower courts, came to the Supreme Court under Chief Justice Taney, who wrote the decision that went far beyond the issues in the case, which courts almost never do, and said, among other things, that blacks are not citizens under the Constitution. They have no standing in court, and they have no rights that a white man is bound to respect. So the die was really cast at that point about what was going to happen between slave and free. But one more incident took place that struck terror into the hearts of Southerners, and that was John Brown from Kansas and his raiders laying siege on Harper's Ferry, the arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. And they had really a very small force. I think they had 13 whites and 5 blacks. And they held Harper's Ferry for only about 24 hours, and then they were overwhelmed by a force that was led by Robert E. Lee and J.E.B. Stuart. But the idea of a slave rebellion was the one that really, really excited and terrified the Southerners. And so you have Lincoln being elected in November, and then you have the firing, South Carolina seceding from the Union in January of 1860, and then that's followed by Texas and Florida and Alabama and four or five other states. So that by the time Abraham Lincoln is inaugurated in March, the Union has already, in a sense, dissolved. And everybody knew that this, it was pretty apparent that this could happen because the presidential election of 1860 was really two elections. It was the election between Stephen Douglas and Abraham Lincoln in the North and between John Breckinridge and John Bell of Tennessee in the South, because there really were four presidential candidates during that period of time, or during that election. Lincoln, the Republican. Stephen Douglas, the Northern Democrats candidate. John Breckinridge of the secessionist Democrats. And John Bell of the old Whigs in Tennessee and the know-nothings, who thought that perhaps this whole thing could be avoided by simply turning one's back and pretending that slavery was not an issue. Lincoln's great skill over this turbulent period of time between his election and his inauguration was to hold things together so that, in the words of Doris Kearns Goodwin, he could have lost his government before he even had a chance to start. She says, "In the end, though, Lincoln's role was not fully recognized at the time. He was the one who kept his fractious party together when an open rupture might easily have destroyed his administration before it even began. By privately endorsing Seward's spirit of compromise while projecting an unyielding public image, President-elect Lincoln retained, to an astonishing degree, control over an increasingly chaotic and potentially devastating situation." So Lincoln's inaugurated on March 4th, 1861, and on April 12th, 5 weeks later, General Beauregard fires on Fort Sumter, and the Civil War is off and running. Like Dick Cheney in Iraq, William Seward predicted that the war would be over in 60 days. The war lasted 4 years, and it cost 600,000 lives in a population of 23 million. Astonishing. If you have read any of the books about the individual battles, there's one called Landscape Turned Red, I think, about the Battle of Antietam. There is a very, very good nonfiction book called Killer Angels about the Battle of Gettysburg. I really commend both those books to you in your study of American history, because they give you some sense of how incredibly brutal this war was. It was a war that was essentially fought with old-fashioned tactics and modern weapons. And that's why the carnage was so devastating. Think of a Folger's coffee can filled with bolts and screws. That's what canister was that they shot out of cannons, canister or double canister. So what essentially you were getting these troops charging cannons that were shooting out just a wall of metal flying in various directions. The repeating rifle came into play during the Civil War, and of course the revolver. But much of the fighting was hand-to-hand, saber-to-saber, a brutality that it's almost impossible to imagine. Lincoln offered the command of the Northern troops to General Lee. He was his first choice because General Lee was regarded as the best military man in the country. But General Lee said, "How can I draw my sword on Virginia, my native state?" And he declined. And that was about the time that Virginia joined the Confederacy, and Lee resigned his commission in the United States Army and became the general of the Confederacy. But Lincoln's goal from the beginning was always to preserve the Union. And here is what he said about preserving the Union. "I consider the central idea pervading this struggle is the necessity that is upon us of proving that popular government is not an absurdity. We must settle this question now, whether in a free government the minority will have the right to break up the government whenever they choose. If we fail, it will go far to prove the incapability of people to govern themselves." And what I thought about when I read that was, gee, we have the initiative here in Oregon, which is precisely that tool that Lincoln so feared. And it has been used as such a bludgeon, I believe. I think we need to rethink how it is used in our current governance situation. And of course, that's one of the reasons we read history, is to help advise us about what's going on in our lives currently. Harry Truman said, the only thing that's new is the history you don't know yet. Another thing that characterized Abraham Lincoln is that when his administration screwed up, for example, the lax administration of the War Department under his first Secretary of War, Cameron, resulted in rotten food going to the troops and diseased horses being purchased and malfunctioning weapons, Lincoln didn't blame Cameron, but blamed himself, took it upon himself, even though Cameron was actually censured by Congress. As Abraham Lincoln presided over this government, the military situation went from bad news to more bad news. The Union was threatened, and in fact, Washington, D.C. was threatened by the battles of Bull Run, both the first and second battle, one early in the war, one later in the war. But General Lee ran circles around all of Abraham Lincoln's generals, and he had a tough time finding one that would actually do the job. He started with, I guess I won't write these down because of time, but he started with Winfield Scott, who was old and sick, went to John Pope, who lost the first battle of Bull Run, then to George McClellan, who fancied himself a second Napoleon, and wrote a number of letters to his wife criticizing everyone, and specifically Lincoln and his cabinet, but who couldn't seem to get his troops to engage in any kind of a battle. Lincoln said that McClellan had a case of the slows and at one point offered to borrow his army if McClellan wasn't using it. And in fact, Lincoln issued war orders out of the White House, which he never intended to do, never wanted to do, but felt he had to do in order to get things going for the Union troops. And there's one instance in the book where Lincoln took a steamer down into Chesapeake Bay, and they were visiting McClellan's encampment there, and Lincoln was trying to get McClellan to attack Lee, and McClellan had all sorts of reasons why he wasn't ready to do it and all of that. And Lincoln finally said, "Go take Norfolk." Well, that wouldn't have happened if Lincoln hadn't commanded him to go take Norfolk. But what actually happened was, because Lincoln commanded it, Norfolk was abandoned by the Confederacy, and the ironclad ship Merrimack was scuttled. it wouldn't have happened, except for the fact that Lincoln finally got frustrated and said, go do something. As to the freeing of the slaves, what happened was that the moral issue had always been on the table, but it became a military issue. Daily reports from the battlefields illuminated the innumerable uses to which slaves were put by the Confederacy. They dug trenches and built fortifications for the army. They were brought into camps to serve as teamsters, cooks, and hospital attendants so that soldiers were freed to fight in the field. They labored on the home front, tilling fields, raising crops, and picking cotton so their masters could go to war without fearing that their families would go hungry. If the rebels were divested of their slaves, who would then be free to join the Union forces? The North could gain a decided advantage. Seen in this light, emancipation could be considered a military necessity. And that's what really drove it, ultimately. Lincoln drafted the Emancipation Proclamation and then sat on it for approximately 6 months, going through different drafts, consulting different people, and fearing that there would be a backlash in Europe from the freeing of the slaves, when in fact the reality of it was, and I think Lincoln came to appreciate this, that in fact after the slaves were freed, it would be much harder for any of the European countries to gain a union with the Confederacy. That brings us to Gettysburg, and that battle cost 28,000 Confederate troops, about a third of Lee's army, and 23,000 Union troops. So well over 50,000 men died at Gettysburg. And Lincoln went to Gettysburg not to give the primary address, but to give the secondary address. The primary address was given by Edward Everett, who was a retired Harvard president, who talked for the traditional 2 hours to a crowd of approximately 9,000 people in a semicircle around the platform. And then Lincoln gave his Gettysburg Address, much of the end of which you heard in the Lincoln portrait. And Everett afterwards wrote to Lincoln and said, I should be glad if I came as near to the central idea of the occasion in 2 hours as you did in 2 minutes. But what we see in the Gettysburg Address is what Lincoln learned from Shakespeare and from reading the King James Bible, and that is that sense of rhythm, that sense of the beauty of language and the power of language, which he commanded all of his life. Lincoln went to Ford's Theater more than 100 times during the 4 years that he was president. He was a great fan of theater, and in fact, a great fan of Edwin Booth, the older brother of John Wilkes Booth, the assassin. Edwin Booth was the premier Shakespearean actor of the day. Just to give you a sense of the magnanimity of this man, Abraham Lincoln, Salmon Chase was continually undercutting Lincoln, even though the cabinet became fairly cohesive. And finally, Lincoln accepted Chase's resignation as Secretary of the Treasury. And then, to the amazement of almost everyone, he turned around and appointed him Chief Justice of the United States after the death of Taney, the one who had written the Dred Scott decision. And Lincoln said this, "Now, I know meaner things about Governor Chase than those men can tell me. We have stood together at time of trial, and I should despise myself if I allowed personal differences to affect my judgment of his fitness for the office." He had the strength of character and the self-knowledge to be able to surround himself with the most capable people, regardless of any kind of personal animosity. The other thing that Lincoln had, which was similar to this, but on a much grander scale, was the sense that the South had to be brought back into the Union and made a part of the United States again. And that's why in the second inaugural he said, "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive to finish the work that we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and a lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations." Vintage Abraham Lincoln. Because from start to finish, reunion, preservation of the Union, was his primary goal. This book, I don't know how many of you have read it. I've seen a few copies of it in hands out there. It's not an easy book. I accepted this very nice charge to give you this lecture today because I had started the book and gotten 125 pages into it and put it down 2 years ago. Okay, if I say I'm going to give this talk, I'm going to have to read the book. So I did that, and I am really pleased to have fought my way through it, but it's not an easy read, and I wouldn't suggest to you that it is. The other thing that is my main criticism of this book is that she talks repeatedly about Abraham Lincoln's ability as a storyteller, and she doesn't tell us the stories. But here's one that appears on page 711, I guess, as a reward for having fought your way through. He says, and these stories, incidentally, almost always had a point to them. I mean, they weren't, you know, some of them, I suppose, were just to entertain, but many of them really had a point that he was making. "I felt a good deal like the sick man in Illinois who was told he probably didn't have many days longer to live and that he ought to make his peace with any enemies that he might have. He said that he hated worst of all a fellow named Brown in the next village. So Brown was sent for, and he came to the sick man, and the sick man, in a voice meek as Moses, said that he wanted to die in peace with all his fellow creatures, and that he hoped that he and Brown could now shake hands and bury all their enmity. The scene was becoming altogether too pathetic for Brown, who got out his handkerchief and wiped the gathering tears from his eyes, and after a parting that would have softened the heart of a grindstone, Brown had about reached the room door when the sick man rose up on his elbow and called out to him, but see here, Brown, if I should happen to get well, mind that that old grudge stands." We all know that Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. What I didn't know was the extent of the conspiracy, the assassination conspiracy. There were four conspirators: David Harold, a drugstore clerk; Lewis Powell, also known as Lewis Payne, a former Confederate soldier; and George Ezrod, a carriage maker. The plan was that John Wilkes Booth would shoot Lincoln, that David Harold and Lewis Powell would assassinate William Seward, and that George Ezrod would shoot the vice president. What happened is that Lewis Powell, I don't know what happened to David Harrod, but Lewis Powell was admitted to Seward's house and was able to get in with both a knife and a revolver. The revolver misfired, and instead he clubbed one of Seward's sons with it. Then he raced up the stairs with the knife and stabbed Seward, who was in bed, because Seward 9 days earlier had a bad carriage accident and had broken his jaw. And he stabbed him in the cheek, but ironically, the iron contraption that was there to hold his jaw in place saved Seward's life. He then raced down the stairs, stabbed a soldier in the back and out the door. John Wilkes Booth was well known to the people at Ford's Theater because he had acted there and his brother was a mainstay of the acting company. He was admitted, gave his card to the person at the door of Lincoln's box. Lincoln's bodyguard, whose name was Crook, had to die off that night. walked in, shot Lincoln in the back of the head. Lincoln died the next morning on April 15th, 1865. And in the words of Stanton, the then Secretary of War, he now belongs to the ages. Let me just conclude my part of this, and I hope we have time for some questions, with some of Lincoln's character traits that I think made him such a great man and make him such a continuing role model for us. There are 15 of them, and I'll go through them quickly. First, he was kind. He was a gentle person. Secondly, he was unwilling to make enemies, at least to go out to make enemies. He had a huge amount of both compassion and forgiveness in his soul. He looked continually for middle ground. He kept his word. He was slow to act, and by that I mean he was deliberate in the way he approached his problem solving. But he was the decision maker. He used humor continuously and to great advantage. He did not hold grudges. He sought the best men. He was great at reading the public and the public's mood. He took failure on himself and protected those who were working with him. He was willing to educate the public. And let me just pause on that particular characteristic, because there are so few politicians in this day who are willing to educate us. It's always take a poll and try to get in front of the parade, when in fact the greatest leadership can be the leadership that shows us where we have to go rather than where we presently are. He had an unwavering sense of self. He had great personal courage. And he had great self-restraint. And that made him a great man. I'd be happy to discuss any comments that you might have about the book or questions or whatever. Yes, sir?
Kearns Goodwin doesn't say anything about how Lincoln financed all of the travel and activities. He didn't have a David Plouffe and MoveOn.org. So any sense about what that campaign cost or where the money came from to do what he did? There was a lot of travel.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. No, she does not address that issue at all. I take it you're talking about his campaigns for the presidency.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, certainly the second time around he would have been financed by the Republican Party, but I don't know.
Sir, yeah.
Maybe you do know.
I don't think he didn't campaign. He stayed home.
Right.
He did not go out and travel.
Well, except I disagree with that. I know that he did a lot of traveling around the state of Ohio, and then as he got into the Lincoln-Douglas debates, he did a lot of traveling.
Yes, but the Lincoln-Douglas debates, right. Not for the election itself. I don't think so.
Yeah.
But emissaries were being sent.
Yes.
Well, and that is a point that she makes, that he had a tremendous cadre of very, very loyal friends who spent a lot of time on his behalf. And many of those friends were the lawyers that he had gone on the circuit with because, you know, they would end up sleeping two to a bed or four to a room or something like that, you know, and they became very close friends. Yes?
Sir, I do have some information on his travel. He had done a lot of work for the railroads. And they gave him free transportation.
Ah, that's interesting. If you couldn't hear, she says that he had done a lot of work with the railroads, and the railroads gave him free transportation.
Before his inauguration,
yeah.
He had been an attorney or something as the railroads were coming on,
yeah.
And he got a lot of complimentary travel from the railroads.
Uh-huh. Okay. There's...
No, that's
an answer, yes.
You said that Robert E. Lee ran circles around all of Lincoln's generals. Were there any exceptions later, for instance? How did Grant stack up against Robert E. Lee?
I don't know. Doris Kearns Goodwin doesn't address that specifically. What she does say is that the combination of Grant and Sherman was the strongest that the Union had had. Sherman was in the West, and then he cut down through the South to Atlanta, and at that time Farragut also took Mobile Bay. So there was sort of a confluence of a pretty good leadership in the Union at that time. I have seen some comparisons between Grant and Lee, and Lee always comes out on top, in part because Grant's reputation is besmirched by his fondness for the sauce. But, I think that Grant was a pretty competent general, and he wanted to fight. That was a big difference.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering if you could shed some light on Salmon Chase and his daughter. I'm curious about, he went on to be a Supreme Court Chief Justice. So I'm wondering what kind of a Supreme Court justice he was, and then the rivalry between his daughter and Mary Lincoln, if that had anything to do with him leaving.
No, I don't think so much that the rivalry between Mary Lincoln and Kate Chase had anything to do with his leaving. It was the Lincoln said that Chase had two primary problems. One was that he thought he was indispensable, and secondly, that he wanted to be president, and he could not overcome those. So, I think that it was simply that Lincoln finally got tired of having to deal with this undercutting, and everybody else on his cabinet was urging Lincoln to throw Chase out because Chase was so disruptive to what Lincoln was trying to do. Mary Lincoln had come from a family that had a significant history of mental illness, and she was a mercurial personality herself. She was either in the cellar, or in the garret, or in the dungeon, as they said. There was one instance toward the end of the war, when Mary Lincoln was coming with Mrs. Grant to join their husbands and another general named Hoff, I think, to review the troops. And they were in an ambulance, the road was very bad, and they had to get out and walk through the mud, and were late, and the review had already started. And the general's wife was reviewing with the three men, and Mary Lincoln was so incensed by that that she caused this huge public outburst. She was known by the two secretaries of Lincoln, Nicolay and Hay, as the Hellcat. So I think that a lot of the competition that was perceived between Mary Lincoln and Kate Chase was on Mary Lincoln's mind, not so much in Kate Chase's mind.
And how was Chase as a Supreme Court?
He was really quite good as a Supreme Court justice, actually, because he had been such an abolitionist from the get-go that he was willing to enforce then the 13th Amendment. I'm not sure how long he served, but I think he served through the time that the 14th and 15th Amendments were also passed. So, the initial enforcement of those would have come to him. Yes?
For those that are interested in the assassination and conspiracy, there was a book reviewed here a year or two ago called Manhunt. Deals with day by day what happened prior to and through the ultimate capture and killing of Booth.
Uh-huh.
It's a fascinating book.
Yeah. Well, the account of it here, particularly the one of the mayhem that was caused by Lewis Powell in Seward's house, apparently the doctor was called, and they would take the doctor from one injured person to the next injured person, and the doctor kept remarking, how many men were in here with knives. Yes?
Would you like to project the use of the book and its lessons for today?
Well, I think that those character traits that I named are character traits that would serve one well in political office anytime. I think that they are in short supply today, as our campaign, at least our campaign for state senator, Oregon senator, showed us. But I am hopeful that President-elect Obama has many of these traits. I think it's too early to make those kinds of projections, but
write the book.
I have great hope. He has read the book, you say?
Yes.
Yes. This is good. This is good, yes.
I'd like to share that on Friday, President-elect Obama purchased from the Friends of the Library, Lincoln the Warriors.
Aha, the Warriors. Okay, good. Well, thank you so much.